News. Libraries are dead? Most librarians would say the answer is no, but that libraries are going through some serious growing pains. Books are being replaced by digital downloads, and search engines have killed the Dewey Decimal System. But that doesn't necessarily mean all the good information is getting out there or that students know how to find it when it is. And that may mean that libraries and librarians are even more important than ever. Joining us to talk about the future of university libraries is Patricia Steele, Dean of University Libraries at the University of Maryland. She began at Maryland on September 1st after directing the libraries at Indiana University Bloomington. Pat Steele, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Your first experience working in a library, it is my understanding, came by accident when you were a high school junior living in the Miami area. It is my understanding that your shop class at the time was finishing up a Boeing 707.
And I couldn't do it. But actually, the awful thing is it was junior high.
It was junior
high. And it was a new school. Of course, that was back in the good old days when the girls took home ec and the boys took shop.
Yes.
But the home ec room wasn't ready, so they put all of us into shop. And I failed the first test, which was on tools. And I had an absolute fit. I said, oh, my gosh, I'm going to get an F. I got reassigned to the library, which also did not exist. And this wonderful librarian who let me just unpack the books, accession them, put them on the shelves, create a card catalog. So I was hooked after that.
In shop, I couldn't make a coat hanger. I should have chosen a future as a librarian. I might have done pretty
truly.
Well.
See, now, if you'd said, get me out of here.
Instead of this dead-end career that I have now chosen. Fast forward a few decades, and people are now saying that jobs for university librarians are going to be few and far between in the future. What do you think?
It's interesting. There was just a conference last week or so when Dan Greenstein from the University of California system spoke to a number of librarians and talked about his belief was that the library of the future would be very much smaller. The staff, there would be very little staff. It would be decentralized. Mostly it would be social space, study space for the students, and some special collections. That seems to be an extreme, I think, on one side of how you see it. I do think that we will be smaller in number, but our skills will need to be much more diverse than they are right now or they traditionally have been for librarians. So we're going to need a mix of people with technology skills, with discipline-specific skills that we perhaps haven't had to have before, particularly in the sciences.
800-433-8850 is the number to call if you'd like to join this Tech Tuesday conversation on the future of libraries. What do you think is the future of university libraries? How can these libraries remain relevant in an online world? You can go to facebook.com/Kojo Show and ask a question or make a comment there. We're talking with Patricia Steele, Dean of University Libraries at the University of Maryland. You came to the University of Maryland earlier this month after decades at Indiana University. While at IU, you were involved in a consortium working with Google to put your collections online. Explain, if you would, what that project involves.
The consortium that you're speaking of is the CIC. That's a Big Ten expanded. And we had made a contract. We agreed to a contract with Google to digitize our collections within the CIC, which is probably singly the largest a group of collections in the country. Michigan already had been part of the original five libraries that started the Google Project. And then Indiana got to be the first of the contract to have our materials digitized. And the idea, why it was so exciting to all of us, was that it would guarantee that our collective materials would be online, would be digitized. We did a kind of mini experiment at Indiana to see if we could ourselves do this kind of mass digitization, and found out, no, it wasn't that easy. It was very expensive. It was fraught with all kinds of issues. And we were very grateful to have someone, an organization like Google, who was willing to take this on, because it's quite a monumental task.
It is my understanding that seeking to cooperate with the Committee on Institutional Cooperation is the University of Maryland.
We will. Well, I told my colleagues that
cooperating with Google on this, that is.
Exactly. We do want to become a Google library. At this point, when new players come into it, Google looks at what's unique in their collections, because they don't want to duplicate work that they've already done. And the aggregate is going to make the full collection at the end. I think they now have 10 million plus items in their database. And some of us in academic libraries like to think of being able to say to our users, because counts of volumes used to define libraries, and of course it doesn't anymore, but we can say to our users at any library, at a community college library, at a small college someplace, I have a collection, or we will be able to say, we have a collection of 10 million available to you. That isn't done unless you're Harvard, you know.
Do you think university libraries should put their resources in an online project like the Google one you just heard described here? Call us at 800-433-8850 or shoot us an email to kojo@wamu.org. It's a Tech Tuesday conversation. What is the benefit, Pat Steele, for a university to be involved in a project like this?
It allows us to get that basic core collection digitized and searchable for our users. It is truly something that it would take, if it could ever happen, would take decades for libraries to be able to fund and do. And the other side of it is it allows us to then concentrate on what's special, what is unique in our collections. Each of us has, of all size libraries, have very specialized materials that are unique to, in the world. And those are often in archives, hidden in manuscript collections and all, where people often don't even know they exist. We can spend our time and resources on digitizing and preserving those and adding to this kind of core that a project like Google can take care of. So I think it allows us to do what we do best and allows the commercial side of the world to take care of that core.
It used to be that if you wanted to access a resource at a particular university, you had to travel to that university. Are those days pretty much gone? What kind of collaboration do you foresee among different universities in the future?
Collaboration is a very strong word, and I see the Library of the Future as being really a nexus of all kinds of partnerships and all kinds of cooperative ventures. In the area of collections, we will have the basic digitized core of materials available and the specialized materials I talked about. But we'll also have the online databases. We'll have materials that are available throughout the world that will be digitized. And users, yes, to see the print, in particularly when you're talking about specialized collections, always will be important to researchers. But to have them available digitally for searching to see, is what's in that archive at whatever university what I really need? To be able to do that initial sorting and all makes it actually magic. And the other thing I think can be exciting for librarians is to take these various collections and put them in context for our users. You talked about all this material being out there. That's one thing librarians have always been able to do, and that is to collect and then organize. And we're just collecting and organizing in a different environment now.
On to the telephones, and we'll start with Charlotte in Northern Virginia. Charlotte, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say, recently the city of Philadelphia was having such a budget cutbacks that they were on the verge of closing down all of their libraries, and there was kind of an uproar throughout the city. And I feel like it's great to have these books digitized for preservation, but technology can often fail. So it's important to keep these libraries, if for nothing else than a book museum and a refuge for students to go to you know, focus and study. And let's not forget that there are poor people who will not be able to afford computers and use these resources. It's wonderful to be able to go to a library, especially with kids, and explore the books and just the smell of libraries. I really think that a library is kind of a church for the intellectual, a church for the mind.
Pastille?
Yes.
Is there a distinction to be made between public libraries and university libraries at all?
Both of us have
I walk into both.
libraries are there to serve their users, and we have different clientele, but our basic mission is the same. And I'm really very pleased to hear a question about space, because that is my that really can get me started talking, because library as space is absolutely critical, and it's being used very differently. My career in libraries for a number of decades was in the branch library area, where you knew your clientele, you developed the collections they needed, you provided the instructional services and all. Now the relationship with faculty is changing in terms of how we partner with them. But the space that the students need now, the way learning is occurring is very, very different. There's much more collaborative work among students, and libraries provide the place where the resources are there, the expertise is there, and often the expertise is expanding beyond simply librarian reference expertise, but also includes information technology specialists there that can help students while they're working with the technology. It has writing tutorial services, math and statistical help, GIS help. So it becomes a nexus. I was playing last week with a little saying that I could use for the library, but I'm always having trouble saying it, so it's probably not a very good one. But it was stop one, one stop. That's what I'd like the library to be. And stop is part of it. And this physical space is important. You're absolutely right.
Stop one, one stop. That's your library. Here is Andy in Havre de Grace, Maryland. Andy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. Welcome to University of Maryland. I graduated from University of Maryland in 1973. And my son is in Bloomington getting his PhD.
Oh!
So I'm sure he appreciates your labors. What I'm calling about, I used to love to study in the math library and Zoopsych and in McKeldin. And as I remember from the early 70s, from McKeldin Library, that was a favorite place for relationships to break up. And often deep in the stacks, you would hear a, "You won't, you won't," and you'd hear sobbing behind the stacks. And I tell you, it was the greatest place to have semi-privacy, and everybody knew that's where you went to break up a relationship.
This relationship isn't going well. Let's head over to the library.
Andy. No, I didn't do it myself. I didn't have the guts.
Andy, thank you very much for your call. Libraries are memorable for a number of reasons. This is the first I've ever heard, Pastille, a library being remembered for being the place to break up.
I have to say, I've heard of it as just the opposite, as a location.
Thank you.
So we won't go there.
Thank you very much for your call, Andy. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on the future of libraries with Patricia Steele, Dean of University Libraries at the University of Maryland. You can still call us, 800-433-8850, or if you have a question or comment about the future of libraries, send us a tweet at Kojo Show. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. Whether for the work group or enterprise, they help federal agencies manage projects with technology solutions and specialists. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the MyoTech Corporation Center for Community Prevention and Treatment Research, designing evaluations of our nation's critical public health initiatives, career opportunities at MAYATECH.com. From the German Embassy and the German Information Center, presenting Germany.info, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall in a spirit of gratitude to the American people. More at Germany.info.
Every morning I listen to Morning Edition, waking up to it and getting my son ready for daycare and heading off to work.
We like to start recruiting our listeners young.
Just like I was when I was a kid, listening to it every morning, getting ready for school. It's, I guess, kind of a family tradition for us.
As soon as Mom or Dad buckled you in, we had you. Let us be part of your tradition. Tune in to Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's Morning Edition, every weekday morning from 5 to 10 on WAMU 88.5.
Partly sunny skies for this afternoon. Our high today will be around 70 degrees, with west winds gusting up to 25 miles an hour. Overnight readings will drop into the upper 40s. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the upper 60s, with wind gusts to 20 miles an hour. Now back to the conversation on the Kojo Namdi Show.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation with Patricia Steele, Dean of University Libraries at the University of Maryland. She just started there on September 1st. After directing the libraries at the Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. And there's a lot of conversation about getting library documents digitized by Google. Let's start that part of the conversation, or this part of it, with Beth in Reston, Virginia. Beth, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Dean Steele.
Thank you.
I'm a graduate student at the University of Maryland, and so one of my big buzz issues is, how are we going to access those digitized documents? Because I know that right now there's nothing more frustrating than going on, doing the research to find that, you know, such and such a document exists, and then finding out, oh, well, it's actually not available. Or your association or your institution doesn't subscribe to that service, so therefore we can't get to it.
Here are a few additional comments we got on that, Beth. We got a tweet which said, a library should be open to everyone. Since when is knowledge to be isolated? And there have been, Pat Steele, a lot of legal battles over Google's efforts to make the text of books more accessible online. So talk about that. Whether or not people think it will be as easily accessible as it is when you walk in the bricks and mortar library.
Well, of course, when you talk to users, whether they're faculty, students, even the general public in public libraries, because I do have some experience there being on a board of trustees for our library for a number of years. The first thing that people ask for is online access, full text online access. That's the number one resource that they want us to purchase. And Beth, I can appreciate your frustration. We can't always afford everything that we need to provide to you, and that's in these economic times quite a struggle, but another whole discussion about how the university might take some role in reversing some of the publishing cost and so forth in which we're involved. But the access to users and the Google project, of course, there is a lawsuit now, the settlement. I think that it's this month or early October is when the judge is
Southern District of New York
is bringing that back to the table. Assuming that the settlement goes forward, there will be among many other things, service and so forth. There will be a product to which universities can subscribe. Libraries, public libraries, will have at least one free. Terminal that will allow you to access this whole product. There will be opportunities for individuals. You know, there are lots of arguments about how many things are in public libraries and so forth. But the bottom line is, this is going to be access to the full text of everything that was digitized in this process. So we're talking about probably 15 to 20 million volumes in a relatively short period of time, that are searchable by researchers, and then are connected out to locations where you can get it in your local public library. So it opens access into kind of the dead materials in libraries, those things that are no longer in print. very, very easily.
Now, indeed, the settlement, if it goes through, would allow Google to scan out of copyright and out of print books, as well as the books of cooperating authors and publishers in the U.S. We're not copyright experts here.
No.
But ultimately, if that is done, will the access be free?
There will be a cost to the product, and that's one of the that's one of the areas that that concern people when they talk about this. They feel that there's a monopoly, that having these millions of volumes available and then being accessed through, and we're talking about the things that are not in the public domain.
Right, but the
public domain materials clearly are available to everyone. And so there is concern, you're right, about how expensive this is going to be. I guess I'm a bit of an optimist on all this, because if I look at the Google model, it really is about broad access. And that's what they've been pushing all along in this settlement and everything else. So there's a tension between the control, I think, that the authors and publishers want and the very broad access that really is the Google model. I think Google would be happy to see it just out there, because their revenue comes from a difference. It's not selling the items per se. It's getting people to the site. So I think that the marketplace will prevail, and that it will be an affordable product.
On now, thank you for your call, Beth. On now to Nelson in Silver Spring, Maryland. Nelson, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious as to whether she has any views or knowledge on the decline in the quality of the cataloging produced by the Library of Congress. The library, as much as possible, turns cataloging over to technicians based on copycat, and what that means, for example, is people who have absolutely no knowledge of French, German, Spanish, or whatever are responsible for adapting this product and into the Library of Congress database. And management there seems to be downgrading professional cataloging, both descriptive and subject. And I'm just curious as whether she has any views on that, and I'll take her comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Nelson, for your call. Pat Steele?
Actually, I do. I don't think there are too many things I don't have an opinion on, whether it's informed or not. People can judge. I think that there clearly has been a great deal of controversy about some of the changes that LC has made over the recent years. I think that they are really in the same position that most libraries are in, and that is trying to balance all the new things that we need to be doing to assure that we keep that central place in our worlds, whether there's a public community or whether it's an academic community. And that means making some choices. And I think that the choices that LC and many of us in terms of technical services are making, I wouldn't say are diminishing the product that comes out, but are relying upon that product that comes out having a multiple access points. In other words, if we look at an environment in the near future where everything is going to be searchable digitally, and I believe that that's going to happen, then how important is the catalog record at that point? What does the catalog record mean? And I think that the adjustments that they're making are making some assumptions about how people are going to search and access these materials. And we can find out whether it's right or wrong. But I don't think it's a diminishment in the goal of the library to make the materials accessible. It's just taking a broader approach to it.
And is it possible that there is some confusion here because we're looking at a process while it's taking place for what will ultimately in the future be an easier way to access all of these documents?
It's a very, someone said change is disruptive, and it is a very disruptive time. In fact, it reminds me of a I heard John Seely Brown, the educator, talk about the kinds of people we should be hiring in academia. And it was really quite instructive. It made me think, oh, my goodness, our job descriptions in libraries have to change dramatically. But he talks about the students coming to school today being learning in a very, very different way. He calls them gamesters and questers and tinkerers. And they learn by solving problems. And they fail. They get into these games and they fail and fail and fail. But they keep pushing.
See, you should have stayed in shop.
I should have stayed in shop, doggone it. And he thinks that they learn to master the world that's in flux, that they in these games, and that that's the way the world is now. I mean, the information world is in such flux, we really can't guarantee that this way of doing it is, you know, and that's why the view of public, of the library is all over the map, you know.
We're talking with Patricia Steele, Dean of University Libraries at the University of Maryland, and taking your calls at 800-433-8850. It's Tech Tuesday. If the lines are busy, send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or go to facebook.com/kojoshow and join the conversation there. Here is Andrew in Washington, D.C. Andrew, your turn.
Hi. I'm a recent library school graduate as of last week, so I really hope there are library jobs in the future. But I think we're going to see perhaps maybe an initial downturn in the number of librarians, and then people are going to realize that students don't possess the information literacy skills to go through all this information that's going to be available. And the breadth of information available to students now is so much greater from when it was just paper books. And so I think librarians' jobs are going to change, and that's going to be, librarians will still be vital to education.
That's a fascinating thought, Andrew. Do today's students, Pat Steele, know to reach out to librarians for help with their research?
I'm finding at the University of Maryland they do. I've been absolutely overwhelmed with the quality of the students and their preparation. It doesn't mean, I think, as Andrew says, that they know everything. One advantage that students coming into the university right now have is most of them have had access to databases. In high school, in Indiana, all the schools have access to a basic set of databases. That means students from the time they're in kindergarten in the first grade can start to look at databases and at least have that kind of familiarity. And then, of course, we know everyone's out on the Internet.
Well, the other side of that coin is the stereotype that most students, especially undergraduates, do all their research on Google and mm-hmm. rely on Wikipedia for fact-checking.
Right.
Do you think that stereotype is accurate?
Well, I have to admit the first place I start generally is Google, and if you look at studies of how libraries are used and library catalogs are used, I believe at least 97% of the last study I saw done go to Google first or some kind of commercial search engine. So I think, as Andrew said, it puts the onus on the libraries in really having a much closer relationship with the faculty in setting up the kinds of instruction and support systems. What can we put on the course management systems? We should have all the related materials, whether they're digital collections or that we've digitized ourselves, or databases that are particularly appropriate for a particular course. The librarian should be there as a voice accessible at times throughout the class. So I think, yes, there's a lot for librarians to do, and much of it is in partnership with our students and with our faculty.
Andrew, thank you for your call. We move on to Jeff in Washington, D.C. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, and good morning. My biggest concern, and I've been around for a few decades, is there's no substitute for a real live book collection in stacks that a researcher can go through. I have a couple of advanced degrees, and I know one of them doing a thesis thanks to a law library in another university in the, I think, third sub-basement. I actually found so much old material just by pulling a book off the shelf that looked interesting, went through the table of contents, and there was no substitute for that. And just as an add-on, in terms of Wikipedia, I've already corrected 3 entries that were basically wrong, and I can't imagine doing a lot of research, accurate research, all the way in the past on a computer.
Well, Jeff, you know, some people feel that that's Web 2.0. That's the advantage of Wikipedia, the fact that other people can go there and correct. But let's not go there. I'd like to share with you and with Pat Steele a couple of emails we got on the same subject you broached. The first from Constance in Silver Spring. Online resources are really no substitute for books, real books on bookshelves. When I was working on my dissertation at the University of Maryland, in fact, I often had to look for one obscure fact or statement that didn't appear in any index. I would find it in, for example, a half sentence on page 189 in a 300-page scholarly study. It's possible to find these obscure but essential items if you have the book in front of you to leaf through. Doing this online on a computer screen is an ordeal, and you can't do a word search since you don't know exactly which words the author has used for the essential item you need. So I hope nobody is under the illusion that physical books are now disposable. And this from Michael. I graduated from George Washington University many years ago and recently went back to conduct some research in the library. Browsing the stacks was very helpful in locating some very obscure books and conference proceedings on ocean thermal energy conversion that were published in 1980. On the other end of the spectrum, I've also been making heavy use of Google's book search capabilities and have found many equally obscure books that were not in the GWU library. There's a need for both. Paper books on shelves are fast to browse. It's a learning experience by itself to see how the books have been arranged on the shelves. Serendipity of shelf space is a search technique that should not be lost. Books are never dead. They may not be as popular as they once were, but the knowledge should not be lost. And now you, Pat Steele.
I agree completely. I was an English major. I spent many, many hours browsing. I mean, I think when my technique for writing a paper was to find the general area in the library and then just start pulling things out and looking at them. So I'm all for that. But I want to insert a small example of how this kind of serendipity can work in a digital world too. And I don't think books are going to go away. I think libraries have always had a commitment to the preservation of the book as an object, as a material thing, and we have the same commitment to the digital environment. But in the first, in kind of the initial digitizing that was done at the University of Michigan, they digitized a book, quite an old, small book on beekeeping that no one had taken out in 100 years, probably. That book became an overnight success. I mean, it was a sensation. Everybody was going after that book. So it exposed something because someone could look at these books that are now in that third floor basement or whatever that was described earlier. So there's an excitement, I think, on both sides of it. And I think the caller who said that we need both is exactly right. The part of this revolution we're undergoing is understanding what the search strategies will be over time as the search capabilities, automatic search capabilities improve. It's hard to project ahead to see what it will mean to have this corpus of digital materials. Our delivery of the print, not only some core materials that are there for browsing, will be there for a long time. The object of a book. My son-in-law has a Kindle, and he bought a leather binding for it so that it feels like a book. And I'm told that they're going to develop sprays that make it smell like a book too. So I'm trying to keep an open mind to what happens to my precious books.
Hear that, Karen Munson? Leather binding for your Kindle. Now, if libraries are changing, is the stereotype of librarians also changing. You know, the librarian as a prim old lady, you appear neither prim nor old to me.
Thank you. Thank you. Gee, we should have been on TV then if that's the case. But, that stereotype probably has never been quite correct, although decades ago I was on the admissions, the library school admissions committee for the Indiana University. And I was sharing with someone the other day the number of letters that we would get from people saying, from faculty members saying, you should let the student X into your program. They're very quiet. They like books. They don't, you know, like to interact with people much. And, you know, I would sit even that long ago thinking, this is exactly the opposite of what we need. We have got to have people that reach out, that are personable, that have a good attitude, that can make partnerships. We can't do this work all by ourselves any longer. And so, yes, if that was the stereotype, we have to be just the opposite.
No, that recommendation sounded like a job description for a hermit, not a librarian.
Really?
We're talking with Patricia Steele, Dean of University of Libraries at the University of Maryland. It's Tech Tuesday. And, of course, you can join the conversation. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show, or go to facebook.com/Kojo Show and ask your question or make a comment there. It's Tech Tuesday. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Coming up at 1, One-on-One with Wade Rathke, who founded the now controversial activist group Acorn, plus how foreign aid groups can help quell violence in war zones, the benefits of getting aid to civilians in need, and winning over the hearts and minds of locals. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nnamdi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from University of Maryland, Baltimore County's Department of Information Systems, offering an online master's program in information systems. Applications for spring 2010 are due January 8th. More at onlinems.umbc.edu. From the German Embassy and the German Information Center, presenting Germany.info, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall in a spirit of gratitude to the American people. More at Germany.info. From CEA, the Consumer Electronics Association, launching the Innovation Movement to unite Americans who support innovation and technology-friendly public policies. More information is online at ce.org/innovation.
WAMU 88.5's fall membership campaign begins October 17th, and we're asking for your help now to end one day early. Help to save a day at 800-248-8850 or WAMU.org.
Partly cloudy skies and 68 degrees in Northwest Washington. Now back to the Kojo Nnamdi Show.
It's Tech Tuesday. We're talking with Patricia Steele, Dean of University Libraries at the University of Maryland, about the future of libraries. We got this email from Anne, who is president of the Friends of the Library in Montgomery County. Would you please ask your guest to comment on future technology, training, and programming needs for public libraries in general? I ask this because my organization issues grants to the Montgomery County Public Libraries to help our 21 branches address future needs in these areas.
The preparation of librarians to do this work is critical, because it is very different, particularly in public libraries, for the technology to take as large a kind of piece of things as it probably will become in the future. Public libraries are starting to let you download audio books, give you devices for that. They of course have all the databases and so forth. They let you interact. You can renew your books online and that sort of thing. But they're going to have to grow in terms of the support that they provide users as the environment changes and develops over time. Public libraries already have a very large role to play in training users and in introducing them to this. And I think a caller earlier talked about, kind of alluded to, the digital divide, and that is of economically disadvantaged groups finding libraries very important. And I think one of the sad things about the whole event in Philadelphia that was alluded to earlier is that they were looking in a time of economic challenge to close public libraries when historically that's when the greatest use of public libraries has occurred.
You can't pay for the books anymore.
You can't pay for the books. You also get services that public libraries provide in terms of helping people hone their job skills, pull together resumes, do job searching, make connections in ways that on their own is very, very difficult. So it's that service, librarianship is a service profession, and each category of library finds the way to provide that service. And I think introducing users to this new technology, digital environment is part of what we have to do. So there's a training side on the librarian side and on the user side.
Here is Hannah in Germantown, Maryland. Hannah, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, with respect to the future of libraries, I'm wondering if you have a bibliographic instruction for your seniors. Oftentimes, the bibliographic instruction is for what resources are available on campus, although there might be some discussion of interlibrary loan. But in the case of, say, like engineers, there's a book out called Communication Patterns of Engineers by Tenopier and King, which suggests that the engineers, when they get out, they sort of ignore what they've learned as far as bibliographic instruction, and they key to the mentors, which are usually within their engineering firms or something like that, and they sort of lose their bibliographic skills of finding current information. So I'm wondering if libraries, particularly academic libraries, would have some sort of an exit education for people that will tell them what's available now in the communities, especially since they might have had a huge student loan and they can't afford a lot of the subscriptions. I don't know if once a person graduates, say, from the University of Maryland, that as an alumni, they are given like online access to all the periodicals which they got free,
but
you know, for the next couple of years or not. I mean, what kind of education do you give your students so that they can continue their careers in an informative way?
The concept of the exit education, Pat Steele.
I love it. I think one of the things that that it's very clear in this environment, if you don't keep learning, it's like those gamesters. That's your survival, is to constantly adjust and learn. And that's a very interesting, I think it's something that universities in general are wrestling with, is that is how to continue their engagement with the students after they've left the university. Some universities do, of course, licensing doesn't permit us to extend our resources once somebody has left the university. Some alumni associations try to provide some basic access to some basic databases for their alums, not a great number, because generally they're available to people through their public libraries, and the web itself is becoming richer in some ways for finding some basic information. But one of the things that I'm intrigued with, and I haven't been able to develop it fully, is in graduate education, what can we do for our graduate students to create kind of a portal for them that's their personal portal that has the resources they need, that has the tools they need for their publication, that can track their dissertation through time, that can project out to any publications they may do related to it. And that would be something, I think, that they could take with them for their life in some basic way. So it's one little tiny part of, I think, the large concept you put on the table.
You should, of course, know that there is an individual running for office in the state of Virginia who is being haunted by a dissertation that he wrote some 25 years ago, but that's another story.
And libraries preserved it, I bet.
Oh, you better believe it. Hannah, thank you for your call. What's the best way for a student to become a better researcher? Are there particular databases or maybe particular ways of thinking that you'd recommend to an incoming student at the University of Maryland? We've heard about the exit education concept. How about the incoming education concept?
We try very hard to touch all of our incoming students, to be able to provide them the instructions, basic instruction. The easiest thing I can say to them is come to the library, get to know who your librarians are, and work with them. One of the things that if you go to these talks about characteristics of students today, one of them that always that I keep in my mind is they will work with you, they will seek you out if you can help assure their success. They are at the university to succeed. So I like for them to see right away that librarians and using the library is a way to assure that their success. So we need to work with them in the classroom, in the library, and again through their faculty. That's a much more scalable way for us to deal with some of these issues.
What about the professors themselves? Many professors did their research in an era that's quite a bit different from today. What kinds of challenges do librarians have in terms of getting professors to update their research methods and better assist their students?
I think faculty are being pushed by students to adopt technologies if it's not natural to them, and more it is natural to them. They want to use online as much as they can. They want their interactions with faculty to be much more studio-like. That is where the faculty members, they're not necessarily lecturing to them, but being a guide, being someone with whom they can explore topics and so forth. So it gets back to that kind of collaborative things that we were talking about earlier. With faculty, we have a role to play in their instruction, how we can get the right tools at the right time and the right instruction to their students without impinging upon the time that they have with the students too dramatically. The other side is the faculty's research and how we can partner with them to help make that better. And I think it's changing so dramatically. The digital world is changing so dramatically for faculty. They're starting to create databases that they never had. I mean, you know, the day of having our little cards, I always had my little packet of 3x5 cards, and I could write papers from that. Well, now I might be creating databases that someone has to help me figure out how to manage. And some disciplines, the discipline is doing it. I think there's a real strong role for libraries in that, and that gets back to us having to have discipline-specific knowledge and a much greater interaction and partnership with our faculty.
Here now is Matthew in Owings Mills, Maryland. Matthew, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I had a couple of issues. The first one is something I've noticed spreading across Europe is an expanded view of authors' rights that requires libraries pay a fee each time they lend out a book. And I'm concerned about that hitting the United States, and I wonder about your thoughts on it. And the second one is that I know when I've had a couple of friends who've been librarians, and it seems to me that they do an awful lot of drudge work in addition to the higher-level stuff that you need the MLS or DLS for, that they're doing a whole bunch of drudge work that doesn't actually require it, and I'm wondering what sort of actions could be taken so that the...
What kind of drudge work are you talking about in particular?
What I recall actually was, and this was in Erie, Pennsylvania, was they were spending an awful lot of time literally checking books in and out and reshelving them, because somebody thought this was a good way to save money. And I'm thinking, having someone with a master's of library science doing that seems to be not to be a good way to either apply their skills or save money.
Here's Pat Steele.
I couldn't agree with you more. I was on the State Library Board in Indiana, and we were in charge of the standards for libraries. And so when you have hundreds of public libraries, you can imagine you have everything from a storefront that's open two evenings a week and run by the person that they can grab off the street to, and then call a librarian. And, of course, As any professional, we like to think that our professionals are recognized as such and do professional-level work. And this is certainly a waste of this. The kind of a situation you describe is kind of a waste in all kinds of ways in terms of what could be if you allowed that person to do the work they needed to. But, you know, many, many decades ago, a library school professor said, you know, in when you don't have a complement of staff, various levels of staff, the basic work has to be done. And so if that's opening the door and checking out the books, then that's what happens. And that means that it's a library that isn't well staffed, and therefore, you know, the standards make you ask whether it's a library, really.
About the first part of his question having to do with the paying of a fee in Europe?
Yes. Those kinds of models, I can't imagine them really taking off in the United States. It's in many kind of models that are in Europe. I've heard of referred to in the healthcare debates and all that. You know, they won't fly in the United States. We're used to we had the conversation earlier about the Free Library of Philadelphia. Well, no library is free, but the concept of free is one that's very strong in the United States.
We're running out of time very quickly, but these days there are an increasing number of publications that are based on the web. Is there any danger that those materials are not being archived? And if so, what's the best way of saving them?
The web archiving is a huge issue. There are products that you can buy that most libraries do have. Doing a test right now, a project at the University of Maryland using one of these products, which will, among libraries, we all have to kind of stake out our part that will take those web sites in and make sure that they are there. But you can imagine it's huge. I mean, it was very easy in a world where there were a certain number of volumes that got printed every year. I think internationally we're up to nearly 1 million a year of books being published still in this digital age. So that was kind of easy compared to everyone putting up a web, everyone having a say and whatever. And what's important to keep, talk about collection development, there's a whole project for somebody forever.
And I'm afraid we're out of time. Pat Steele is a founding board member of a project called Clocks. It's a joint venture between scholarly publishers and research libraries to preserve web-based scholarly publications. Patricia Steele is dean of university libraries at the University of Maryland. She began on September 1st. Thank you very much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Namdi Show, reviving a long-neglected corner of the district. 40 years after the D.C. riots, whether you can drive neighborhood economic development by offering bars, restaurants, and makeshift public transport. Plus, why one young working mom ran away to join a Negro League baseball team. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CEO.